Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, a groundbreaking device in its day because it featured a music player, phone, internet connectivity, and a sleek 3.5-inch LCD touchscreen. More than a billion have been sold in the decade since, making the iPhone one of the most popular devices on the planet. Joining us now is the host of the Internet History Podcast, Brian McCullough. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks for having me back in.
So Apple produced several prototypes before reaching the final design of the first iPhone. How did the process work?
Well, it was sort of two-track. First of all, you have to remember in the early 2000s, the iPod was very, very popular. So one idea originally was to simply take an iPod and add phone capabilities to it. There were even early designs that incorporated that famous click wheel that the iPod was famous for. You would select songs by scrolling through the wheel. And so in an early prototype, you were supposed to dial that way, almost sort of like an old rotary phone. but then at the same time, they had been experimenting with tablet devices and with multi-touch technology. So in a way, you could say that before there was even an iPhone, there were some sort of skunk work projects to create what would eventually become the iPad. An Apple engineer has famously said that the product spec that he got from Steve Jobs was that he just wanted a device that he could use to check his email while on the toilet. So essentially, when
Yay,
you
Steve.
Have... Right. So essentially you have these two tracks coming together, and sometime around 2004, after the iPod has become so successful, inside Apple, they realized that if there's one thing that could eat the iPod lunch, it would be cell phones, because why would you want to have two devices in your pocket when you could have one? And so that sort of unified into this idea of creating one unified device, which would eventually become the iPhone.
What were some of the challenges that they faced?
Well, basically, no one had ever done a touchscreen consumer device before. And so just getting the touchscreen to work, you know, famously, people were skeptical that you would ever be able to type reasonably well on a small, you know, sheet of glass. So the software problems in actually making the touchscreen work were myriad, and apparently it was quite a difficult thing to pull off. But also, just for creating a phone, if you remember, Apple had basically no background and no experience with things like radio transmissions, radio waves, simple things like the radiation that a cell phone gives off during its use. And so essentially, Apple had to, from scratch, learn how to do all the myriad of engineering tasks that are necessary to create a phone that will work reliably.
You've speculated, and I think this is really interesting, that the smartphone revolution would not have occurred for another 5 years without the iPhone. First of all, why 5 years? What's the magic in that number?
Well, actually, I probably subconsciously took that from Steve Jobs, who said when the iPhone was announced that they were 5 years ahead of anybody else. So I kind of think he was right. That's been proven out. It wasn't really until around 2010, 2011 that Android phones could be reasonably said to be on par with what Apple was producing. But the reason that I say that the mobile revolution would have been delayed is what you get with that first iPhone is sort of this, oh, that's dead obvious to me. I could use that. At the time, you know, BlackBerries were exceedingly popular among business users. BlackBerries, you know, famously with their hardware keyboards and things like that. So it wasn't that mobile wasn't already happening, but what hadn't happened is that a mobile phone, mobile computing was not dead obvious to everyday users, to, you know, my mother, say. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had told me in 2007 that my mom would today be using a smartphone on an hourly basis, I would never have believed you.
And Apple was able to breach that chasm.
I think so. I think that the simplicity of the touch device, the simplicity of it just being one screen, so its use case is obvious. And then, obviously, what we're used to now, you know, with your smartphone, making calls is almost secondary. The fact that the iPhone really taught us that we all could and would want to have internet connectivity on the go is sort of that's the real revolution, is convincing non-technical people, non-business people, that on-the-go computing is something that's actually quite valuable in everyday life.
Guess what? It's the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone. That's what we're talking about today right now on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, you know, I'd love to hear from a listener or two who actually had one of the first iPhones and, you know, what your experience was 10 years ago. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, getting back to the issue of what Apple could and couldn't do, or was good at and wasn't good at, or knew anything about, Steve Jobs was reluctant to work with other companies when designing the iPhone. What persuaded him to work with AT&T?
Right. Apparently, Apple had a much better relationship with Verizon than AT&T, but Steve Jobs didn't want to work with any of the cell phone companies, because basically in the early 2000s, the mobile carriers had all the power. They dictated what phones were allowed on their networks. They dictated the design of the phones. They dictated what the phones could do. There was no full web browsing on any phone before the iPhone, not because it wasn't possible, but because the carriers had the power to prevent that as a feature. So essentially, Singular, which became AT&T, but we know as AT&T today, at the time was in second place behind Verizon, which was the more dominant carrier. So Singular AT&T was looking for a hit, was looking for something to differentiate itself, and basically gave Steve Jobs carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. You'll notice that there's never an AT&T or Verizon logo on an iPhone, unlike on other phones.
Right.
That Steve Jobs would never have allowed dictation by the carriers of what he could and couldn't do. He was going to design a phone/computer that he wanted, and he needed a partner that would just allow him to do whatever he wanted. And just by coincidence of history, Singular AT&T was hungry enough at the time to allow him to do it.
I suppose that's one of the biggest revolutions in all of this, isn't it?
Well, that in the same way that Apple famously basically revolutionized the music industry, got all of the major record companies onto the iTunes store. Basically, Apple, repeating history, blew open the market for what you can do on your cell phone and on wireless internet. The phone companies have always been afraid of becoming dumb pipes, where all you're paying for is just to use their minutes or use their data. They were always hoping that they could sell you internet, that they would sell you, oh, you want your email, you pay us $10 a month. You want weather, you pay us $5 a month. So, yes, the fact that they are essentially at this point dumb pipes, yeah, is basically what the revolution that the iPhone allowed to happen.
How was the iPhone received when it first debuted? It was way too new for me to imagine having one at the time, but how was it received?
Famously, sort of mixed. There was a lot of people who were super enthused by it, as with most Apple products. It was nicknamed the Jesus phone because it was so hyped. But so many people, and there was a lot of articles that were posted yesterday that accumulated some of these negative reviews. There were so many people that were skeptical. One of the biggest things was, hey, it doesn't have a hardware keyboard. I'll never use this. Mm-hmm. But there was also a lot of downsides to the original iPhone. It was on the slower non-3G network. So even though you had a full decent web browser, it was very, very slow to use to actually load web pages. It didn't have things that were common today, like GPS. You did have maps on it, but you had to use cell tower triangulation to figure out where you were. So a lot of people saw it, rightfully so, as sort of a bit of a hobbled device. And the biggest thing that it didn't have that people forget is it didn't actually have the app store. You know, we think of our phones today as these utility belts of tools that allow us to do basically anything. Mm-hmm. The original iPhone launched without third-party apps, without the app store.
Well, what did you have then?
you had
what they gave you.
You had what they gave you. You know, Apple made an email app. They made, you know, Safari web browser app. There was Google Maps. They worked with Google for that. And then there was a Yahoo weather widget as well. And then Apple had its own stocks widget, I believe. But there was, right, if you think of the iPhone screen as we know it today, you basically had that first screen of apps. There was no need for a second screen because there were no other apps that you could put on it.
Let's hear from Austin in Columbus. Austin, you had one of the first?
Yes. I had the classic iPhone.
Yeah.
That didn't have a frontward-facing camera for selfies. So it was interesting to move from that and to be so excited about the next iPhone, which had the ability to actually record video, because the first iPhone couldn't record video either. And I believe it was like a 1.9 megapixel camera on the back. So
I think it was two, but yeah, really
weren't exactly awesome. But it, I mean, it's really come a long way. And I remember, you know, my friends having Androids and me feeling like I was the superior iPhone guy because they had the cheaper Android option. And now where Android is so comparable. It's really interesting to see where everything's gone.
Yeah, the camera was a super big deal, right, Byron McCullough?
Well, I mean, it was a super big deal, again, because of the screen, because of the fact that you could take photos and then immediately display them on that, what at the time was an enormous screen, 3.5 inches.
Yeah.
But as he rightfully points out, there was no video, and it was, I think it was a 2-megapixel camera. But yeah, the fact that that was still at the very beginning when having any sort of a camera on a cell phone was sort of a new thing. So, you know, one of the things, that Apple, executives pointed out yesterday is in their mind, 10 years later, the one of the biggest things that has evolved is that the fact that the camera on an iPhone is basically as good as or superior to most SLR cameras today. And it's just this tiny little camera that sits at the top of your phone that sits in your pocket all day long.
How did expanding the App Store to third-party developers affect iPhone's popularity? What was a big change, right?
Well, yeah, I think so. When you get back to your question of the mobile revolution would have been delayed 5 years, yeah. I think it's because of that. It's the fact that, you know, if I had come out 15 years ago with a standalone device that allowed you to take a picture of text and translate it into any language that you wanted, you would have called me a genius and I probably would have made hundreds of millions of dollars. But guess what? That's just one app in the App Store. You know, think of the 5 or 6 apps that you use every day. You know, the app that tells you it's about to rain in 10 minutes. The app that, you know, where would Twitter be? Where would even Facebook be?
Yeah.
If you think about it, the mobile phones, and so the mobile revolution is the perfect both consumption device for social media, but also the production device for social media. You don't have to take a picture, download it to your computer, then upload it. You can be at the party, take a picture of the grandkid blowing out the candles on the cake, and immediately post it to Facebook. So that revolution of mobile that we know today, of social media that we know today, would have been delayed because it would have taken a while for the uptake that the App Store and the iPhone allowed to happen.
Wow, a lot of change. What's next for iPhone, Brian McCullough? I mean, what can they break the mold again?
Well, it's very interesting. So next year will be it'll be the 10-year device, and there's been a lot of rumors that this is going to be a major update to either the design, what the phone is capable of. People have been complaining that the iPhone has sort of seemed like it's stayed the same. It's treading water for the last couple of years. And there's been a lot of speculation that the reason that they're treading water is because they want this 10-year device to be the next revolution, the next huge step forward. So we'll see if that pans out sometime in the late summer, early fall.
Yeah, Apple's always been big on the show. Brian McCullough, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
Brian McCullough is the host of the Internet History Podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Our world is more digitized than ever, but the appeal of real objects persists. Take music. MP3s and streaming music are the most popular ways music is consumed these days. But a recent market report showed that in 2016, sales of vinyl records increased following a decade-long trend. Author David Sacks has written about the penchant for real versus digital in his new book entitled The Revenge of the Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
This, as I was thinking about it, I was thinking this is sort of an anti-Tech Tuesday segment, right?
Well, analog is a different type of technology. It just happens not to be the one that doesn't speak with ones and zeros, but you can still do a lot with it. And I think that is, you know, the people who are adopting analog technologies either for the first time or sort of again are not doing it while sort of abandoning digital technology, right? Mm-hmm. I listen to records, I read books, I use paper and pen. I'm still sitting here in front of my laptop and with my smartphone. So I think it's that duality that is kind of the driving force behind this.
The renewed interest in vinyl records started you off on the journey of writing this book. So I wondered, are we talking just about nostalgia or is it something more?
I think it's something more. I mean, nostalgia plays a role. And I think I hesitate to use the word nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And I tend to sort of find it dismissive of this. Oh, this is just, you know, hipsters being nostalgic. It's not significant. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something deeper. Perhaps nostalgia gets people interested in it. But what has allowed sort of analog technologies to both endure and grow over the past couple of years? I mean, vinyl record sales went from sort of a low point in 2006 to now they've grown, I don't know, 15 times since then, and continue growing by double-digit numbers every year, is something deeper than that nostalgia. And it's that it provides a benefit or an experience either in people's personal lives or their professional lives, the way they relax, the way they take in culture, or the way they work, that is different and in some ways better for them than what digital technology can do. And I think that deeper interaction with the technology is what has sort of given this a broader cultural movement and sort of greater longevity than I think most sort of pessimists would have imagined.
I don't mind using my e-reader, but if I'm preparing, particularly for work, for an interview, I want the book. I want to be able to fold over the page to tell myself there's something in there that I'm interested in talking about, that kind of a thing. I want to underline things. And I know you can do that on the e-readers, but it's not the same tactile experience. It doesn't have the same effect on me.
Yeah, and you're not alone, right? When the Kindle came out in 2007 or 2009, there was the expectation that this would do for books what, you know, the iPod did for physical music. And while ebooks have certainly grown and Kindle sales, you know, occupy a significant portion of the publishing world, I mean, it's still overwhelmingly paper books and printed books that people are reading of all ages across sort of all subject matters. And book sales have not declined. If anything, they're growing again, as well as physical bookstores. And I think it's for some of the reasons that you talked about, right? There are studies that show that, you know, we cognitively understand and take in more when we're reading something in paper for the different reasons. We're touching it. We understand where the page is simply by feeling it with our fingers. Okay, this is close to the front and this is the back versus those little numbers at the bottom. But I think there's even more sort of reasons why people gravitate towards reading in paper and reading books, right? There's the social aspect of going to a store, of looking at someone's bookshelf, of talking to someone about something you can hold in your hand, giving it to them, right? This holiday season's just passed. How many people gave books as gifts? You can't really give an ebook as a gift. There are ways to sort of pass them on, but it's not the same, right? Mm-hmm. And I think only when that was sort of threatened did people finally come to realize the value, sort of the unspoken value of the physical book beyond just the words and the text that they find in it.
You wrote about cameras and those who prefer to use real analog film In this case, the limitations of the medium can be seen as an asset. And I do hear people talk, and lots of people more and more talk about, yeah, I love my camera on my phone, and I love that I can show you the picture right away and share it on Facebook or Twitter or whatever that may be, or Snapchat or whatever. But a lot of people are saying, gosh, it's such a hassle to get a picture printed out nowadays.
Yeah, and I was thinking what Brian was talking about just before about, you know, the grandparents at the kid's birthday party.
Yeah.
My daughter is 3.5 years old. I have a son who's 5 months. I printed one album for my daughter's first year of life. It took us an entire year just to get around to printing that album. I haven't printed a single picture since then. I haven't printed a single picture of the baby who's now 5 months old. And, you know, in my computer, in my hard drive, in the cloud, I have, I don't know, 30,000-40,000 photos when I first got a digital camera, but just, you know, a handful of albums and printed pictures. If I take the old Polaroid camera I have and go out and buy a package of Impossible Project Film, which is the company that makes film for Polaroids now, it's going to cost me $25 for 8 pictures. Yeah, those pictures are not going to come out as crystal clear and perfect as they will on my iPhone, and I can't share them, whatever. But at least I'll have it. At least it's there, and I can put it up on my mantle or take a thumbtack and put it into my daughter's wall of this photo of her. And there's something great about that, that instant gratification, but in a physical sense. And it's interesting because, you know, one of the best-selling products in the camera market these days are not point-and-click digital cameras. Those have been declining, you know, since the iPhone 4 came out. It's instant film cameras like Fuji's Instax, which is essentially the same as the Polaroid cameras. And they're growing. You know, their biggest growth market is in kids who are, you know, 10 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old. They're not nostalgic for this. This is something new, and they're seeing it for the first time. These are people who've only grown up with digital photos. They've only known photos on tablets and smartphones.
For them, it's an innovation.
It's an innovation, and the pleasures of it are real and instantly accessible because they can take a photo with their friends. It'll come out of the camera. They can watch it develop for their eyes and hold it in their hands and give it to their friend and write on it in a way that's very different and rewarding in a different way from taking a photo on Snapchat and putting in a dog face or whatever they're doing.
It's funny. I wonder if it's that same sort of thing when it comes to the photo booths kind of a thing and why those have endured for so long.
Exactly. And I think, again, it's not, you know, in the world of digital, the people who create that technology and are advocates for it, you know, the Consumer Electronics Show is this week. It's full of all the tech nerds in the world talking about how great things are. You know, they tend to compare things on a purely quantitative, you know, quality basis, right? Well, look at the grain of the photo. Look at the features you can do with it. But analog doesn't win on that anymore. Listening to vinyl records, it's not about the quality of the sound. You can have a bad, scratchy record on a cheap turntable, and it'll still be more engaging than the best digital stereo and the highest quality, lowest compression file, because the experience, the overall experience, is so much more involved in what you have to do to access that culture that the reward is greater, or the reward is at least different than what the digital equivalent is. And I think that's something that we sort of brushed off and thought, well, once we were done with that, you know, we wouldn't need it. And increasingly, as so much of our life has become, you know, packed behind that little small piece of glass, we crave something else. We crave something beyond the same machine that we are using for work and for pleasure and we are on every day. What else is there out there? And so the resurgence of analog goods and other ideas is largely driven by that.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about why real things still matter in a world that is increasingly digital. My guest is David Sachs. He's written a book about the topic. It's called The Revenge of the Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, David Sachs, I was thinking when you were talking just now about how all the different What's the word? You know, when you take a picture, you have all the different aspects. You can do the sepia, the whatever they call them. And I at the time, I thought, why do they need this? But now, of course, as soon as you get into that 1960s thing, there's something charming about it. There's something something that we actually like about it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is, you know, the joy of it, right? It's again, the tactile nature and the limited nature. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, an analysis paralysis that comes with too many options. Mm-hmm. And there's something sort of simple and rewarding about having too few. When I pick up a book to read it, it's not going to send me messages. I can't do anything except maybe write on it or fold down the pages as you talked. And, you know, it's rewarding and fulfilling, especially when so much else will, you know, bombard us with information.
Getting back to the whole, you know, the idea of real film and so forth, you've been talking about Polaroids and that kind of a thing. What about regular film and where to get it processed? And is that all going away, too? I mean, are we not going to be able to get it eventually? Or will we all go back having our dark room in the back room?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Kodak, which had discontinued a large number of its products, just re-released the other day Ektachrome, which is a film format that it discontinued less than a decade ago. And it's because the growing demand for film from sort of this niche of film photographers is significant enough for many of these companies, whether they're new companies or sort of the legacy film companies that are still around, to do it. And if you speak to people who have film labs, the sort of remaining ones, the mass market of, you know, 95%, 100% of the population shooting a billion rolls of film a year is essentially gone, and it's never going to come back. But the niche of people who are interested in film are out there, and they're significant. And, you know, the interesting thing is with the internet, with digital technology, it's allowed these sort of disparate lovers of film and records and paper products to find each other and really come together and provide those services to each other, where a couple of years ago that wouldn't have been possible. So there are film labs, you know, around the country that you can set an account up with and send their film, and they'll send you the prints back and scan the negatives and do whatever you have to do so that it's sort of accessible everywhere, because your local supermarket film kiosk doesn't exist.
Another example you cite is the resilience of the whiteboard. Mm-hmm. Why do you think?
Well, I think there's a number of different. One of them is, you know, the KISS principle. And that is the notion that something like a whiteboard is such a simple technology. And so, you know, you write on it and you can erase it, right? That's all you can do. And a couple of years ago, about a decade ago, along came the first generation of what they call smart boards, which is sort of a computer screen that you can write on, and it projects images from a computer, but you can write back in the computer. And, you know, for teachers, this was supposed to be a revolution in learning and bring all sorts of new information into the classroom. But what most teachers found is that it simply just complicated things. It was one more thing that could go wrong. It got in the way of the teaching and the information. And so many teachers have sort of gone back to using the whiteboard because, while it seems simplistic, it's effective in what it needs to do, communicate things. And there's all sorts of advantages to it that I think the education world didn't realize until they were sort of challenged, which is that when you write something on a whiteboard, it will stay up there until you erase it. So it could stay up there for a week or a semester, as long as something is being taught. Whereas a smart board is, in essence, a computer screen. As soon as the information is off that screen, it's gone. And I think, again, in the world of education, you know, digital technology is often presented as this panacea. Oh, we're going to give tablets or laptops or iPads or virtual reality headsets to every kid in the school, and this is going to, you know, increase test scores and decrease student inequality between minorities and poor students and wealthy students and so on. And time and again, these efforts have fallen flat, you know, in the United States and across the world, and that's because education is a complicated thing. Technology is a tool, but often it's deployed as a solution. And you know, unless it's thought out and balanced in a way, it can often do greater harm than good.
tabletop games, they're still big, and they're cheaper than ever in some ways. And you write that there's a reason for that, why they endure.
Yeah, there's a convention that happens every year in Columbus, where the show's based out of, called GAMMA, which is the Game Association Manufacturer for America, something along those lines, people who make games. And for the past decade, it's grown tremendously. And you know, this has nothing to do with being challenged by video games sort of killing off board games. It's that, you know, board games provide, and tabletop games, whether you're playing Magic cards, Dungeons and Dragons, or something like Cards Against Humanity, even, you know, poker and bridge, they do something that video games in the greatest, most complex and beautiful design of them can never do. And that's bring a bunch of people together around a table to do something and interact with each other face to face, holding hands, laughing, playing intricate social aspects, right? The best video game, the most, you know, engaging one where you can play with multiplayers all around the world simultaneously, talking through headsets or through virtual reality things, at the end of the day, you're still just pushing buttons, right? When you're playing a game of chess or checkers or Settlers of Catan, you're building relationships. And I think, you know, the growth, the tremendous growth of board games and tabletop games over the past couple of years is a direct need for people to find and create opportunities in their lives where they go out and meet people, where they can go somewhere and interact with someone, go to someone's house and do something that, again, is not about a screen, is not about a technology, is about those face-to-face interactions that have been decreasing in our lives.
Puzzles are still big as well, right?
Pardon what?
Puzzles.
Puzzles, yes, yeah. I spent over the Christmas holidays, you know, a solid chunk of 3 hours one day doing a Frozen puzzle from the movie Frozen with my mother, because my daughter abandoned it after 1 minute. She's 3 and a half. It was a little advanced for her. But, yep, you know, there were my mother and I, 300 pieces later, yep, finding the intricate snowflake patterns on Elsa's dress to put together. And it's so simple, right? It is not the most advanced technology, but it's a perfect technology. And again, there's a meditative, you know, contemplative, yeah, joy to that, which has not decreased, and if anything, has increased with the availability of other technologies throughout our lives.
I just finished a 2,000-piece puzzle that took me about a year, and now I can't break it up. I know, it's crazy. I got to get rid of it. But David
just glue it and mount it on your wall.
That's the big joke in our house. David Sacks, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Ann.
David Sacks is the author of The Revenge of the Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Much of the tech world gathered in Las Vegas last week to show off or view the latest innovations at the Consumer Electronics Show, CES. Computer maker Razer had some impressive prototypes on display, so impressive, in fact, that thieves walked them right off the convention floor. Joining us now to talk about that and some other CES highlights this year is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Razer is reportedly offering a $25,000 reward for the return of its Project Valerie laptop prototypes. First of all, what happened? I mean, didn't they have these things laced down somewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. When they were on display at Razer's great big booth, you know, in Las Vegas, they were you know, secured, and there were always people there. But there's just an incredible volume of people moving through at any given time. And when you get to the end of the show, it's time to start taking stuff apart and start, you know, packing everything up and, you know, moving them away. And as they were in the process of doing that, two of these Project Valerie prototypes completely vanished.
What makes them so special? I mean, was there something amazing about them?
So Project Valerie is not a thing that exists yet where they're considering even releasing it as an item to buy. This is just an idea that was had internally at Razer. And it's a 17-inch laptop that actually has the ability to fold out into three monitors. So you have a normal-ish looking laptop, and then if you decide you need more than one screen, you can reach behind it and actually fold out two other very large, very impressive looking 17-inch monitors. So it's a big thing to walk away with.
Yeah, yeah. What are they thinking about with that? Who needs something like that? Do you?
Well, we're it's not when I'm at home, but you know, I do often find myself. You know, I work with multiple monitors at my desk, and so when I'm portable. You know, when I'm working at an event like CES, I usually have my laptop, which has its single screen. And when I'm doing things like video editing, you know, that can be a limiting experience to have a single monitor. I think three is a little out there, especially if they are attached at all times. But that's, you know, Razer is a company that is known for kind of creating, you know, very, you know, kind of out there prototypes and ideas and receiving feedback from people who, you know, would otherwise consider buying them. And the products that come from those concepts are often very successful. So it's possible that, you know, 2 years from now, you know, something like Project Valerie or what comes from Project Valerie would be a new kind of laptop that had, you know, some kind of display extension, maybe not, you know, quite as extreme as what they're showing here. But, you know, the result of that feedback and communication from Razer's audience.
What are the suspicions? I mean, if you steal some fine art, you're not going to put it out in the open market because everybody will know it was stolen. This isn't something you can sell. Is this corporate espionage or something like that? What do they suspect, you know?
Well, yeah, corporate espionage was one of the other, you know, suspicions when Razer made the announcement that the laptop prototypes had, in fact, gone missing. But, you know, having seen and touched these myself, these were very unfinished. You know, the laptop in and of itself, you know, looked very similar to one of Razer's existing laptops, the Blade Pro. And there were these, you know, very, you know, kind of obviously non-finished, you know, hinges on either side to hold these monitors in place. So these were nowhere near finished products. It's difficult to imagine that they would even, you know, be useful on a daily basis, you know, for someone who wanted to just use it. It's almost like these were taken so that they could sit somewhere and be stared at.
Another Razer device that got some attention for all the right reasons was Project Ariana. That's a projector that creates a more immersive gaming experience. What was that? Tell me more about it.
Razer has been, over the last couple of years, very dedicated in shoving LED lights in all of their products in places that you wouldn't normally expect them.
Okay.
You know, these are keyboards that have, you know, just a whole lot more kind of light around them and gaming mice and mouse pads and even their gaming headsets. And they have this service called Chroma that works with video games that you're playing so that the lights all sync up with the game that you're playing. So if you get hit by something in the game, then, you know, the lights on the keyboard and the mouse and everything will flash to match that. And it's supposed to create this more immersive experience. And they've extended that to smart lighting that you may have installed in your home, and then taking it one step further with this projector that they have mounted. It basically, you know, projects more of the game that you wouldn't normally see. You know, basically, you know, when you look at a game and you see, you know, the player's hand, you know, the character's hand kind of extended onto the monitor, this will take the rest of that arm and kind of stretch it out across your wall so that your entire wall basically becomes part of the video game that you're playing. But it's done so in a way that you're still, your eyes are still focused on the television that's in front of you. But it just feels like you are, you know, very much immersed in the game that you're playing.
Is this sort of technology going to be eclipsed by virtual reality, do you think, or what's its hopes?
Well, so Razer actually, they made it very clear that what they considered this was kind of pre-virtual reality. This was something for someone who wanted to feel, you know, just a little bit deeper into the game without fully going into a virtual reality, because Razer has partners working on virtual reality headsets, so they're not trying to step on those toes. with a competing product. But this is definitely more for a group of people sitting in a living room. This isn't so much a solo experience.
Okay. The Asus Zenfone AR smartphone. It's a smartphone that's designed for virtual reality and augmented reality. That's the AR part, experiences. What did you learn about it at the CES?
Google's done a lot of work creating a virtual reality platform and an augmented reality platform, and they've been separate this entire time. They're run by different groups within Google, and they serve very different purposes. The Project Tango, as it had been called until very recently, was being used on the International Space Station and in museums and places like that to kind of offer these single experiences that made those things feel more interactive and helped in various ways. Whereas Google's Daydream virtual reality platform was more kind of entertainment focused and allowed you to kind of immerse yourself in a single experience while you were sitting down instead of up and moving. And this is the first phone that combines those two. You have an augmented reality platform with Tango and the special cameras on the back of the phone that allow you to, move around in a space without and see, augmented reality objects within it. And then if you want to place the phone inside of a virtual reality headset, you gain those experiences as well.
When you're at the CES, how much do you actually get to use the device and play with it?
It varies from manufacturer to manufacturer, basically based on how close that product is to being completed. When it comes to the Zenfone AR, this isn't expected to come out until later this summer. So they gave us a few minutes to play with it, but made it very clear that most of the features were not completely functional yet. So it was difficult to kind of evaluate how this compared to some of the other products that were doing something similar. But it gave kind of a good idea for how thin the phone was and how it compared to, physically to some of the other products that were doing, similar things.
And is that pretty typical at CES at that kind of stage in the game when you see stuff like that? There's a lot of other stuff out there that's not done either, right?
Just about everything that you see at CES is not quite finished.
Okay.
It's, degrees of variance there. But most of the time when you're touching something, this is, they call it pre-production or, something, prototype that they're working on. Unless they have released a product and they have it there for you to touch, usually the things that they are announcing or have, kind of demonstrations for are incomplete in some way or another.
How much are they trying to get feedback from people about what they're doing?
Google?
Any company, Razer, Google, whatever it might be.
That usually depends on the company. CES is kind of this combination of, big public trade show where people can walk in and touch things and kind of an endless series of private meetings that are held off of the trade show floor. And those private meetings are usually much more about, gaining feedback or communicating with companies that would potentially sell products and things like that. So usually, you get a good mix of both from my perspective, where you're kind of participating in both sides. But it's not usual that they would set something up on a trade show floor and then expect feedback that they would, consider valuable.
Amazon, one of the biggest deals at the show this year was the integration of Amazon's digital assistant Alexa and Amazon Echo, right? There were Alexa-compatible air purifier. I mean, is the Internet of Things all over the place, right?
This was a really impressive experience because you could not walk far in the show without finding a new thing that either had Amazon's Alexa service, supported in one way, or actually had the Alexa voice system baked into it. And some of it was really obvious stuff. There were speakers that looked very similar to the Amazon Echo that, had the Alexa service baked in. But there was also a smart shade, like a big outdoor umbrella, that would move based on the position of the sun so that you were, kind of constantly covered by the sun. This kind of very expensive outdoor umbrella that also planned to have Amazon's Alexa service baked into it at some point so that you could, I guess, be laying underneath of the umbrella and then speak to it if you wanted to change something. It really wasn't clear how that was going to work. But there were a lot of services all over the place that either supported Amazon's Alexa service or had Alexa's voice system baked right into it.
How did you like that?
You know, it's a natural expansion. Amazon made it very clear that they wanted companies to put the Alexa service in as many things as possible. It raises a lot of the same questions that we had before Christmas, which was, you know, how many of these things are people actually buying, and how useful are, you know, some of the third-party interactions when it comes to, you know, this kind of natural spoken language to make a command happen. And CES is not a place to gauge, you know, buyer success, because a lot of the things that you end up seeing there don't actually even make it to being sold in stores if a buyer doesn't like the way that it's designed or something and ends up having, you know, creative feedback at some stage. So it's impressive to see that there is a tremendous amount of support for Alexa, but it's still not clear, you know, what that's going to translate into over the next year.
Apple and Google have their own versions of this technology. Amazon seems to have a good head start. All these smart devices, are they going to play with each other, or are people going to have to make a choice, or what?
Well, there are certainly a lot of cases where all of these services are currently playing with one another. You know, Philips Hue bulbs work on, you know, all three of the voice command services, and the same goes for most of the more expensive, you know, kind of smart home systems, you know, the Nest thermostat and most of the door locks and things like that. But there have been, you know, a lot of conversations about the creators of these products trying to gain exclusives and doing so by telling the manufacturers, you know, you can support us and we'll guarantee you this number of users, or you know, or we're not going to grant you support at all. And so it's difficult to see how much of that is happening, because a lot of those meetings are happening behind closed doors. But mm-hmm. I think over the next year we'll see, you know, kind of those dividing lines where each one of these you know, companies has a list of exclusives that aren't particularly long, but can be significant depending on how popular those products end up being.
You liked a camera that was made to take photos of the night sky, and that sounds really cool. It's called Tiny One. How did they do that?
This is a really small astronomy camera, and this is the company that was behind it. There's a very, you know, small group of developers and engineers who wanted a compact astronomy camera, and they did this by making the sensor very small enough that it's not going to be particularly functional for a lot of daytime photography, especially when compared to what you would take with your smartphone at close range. Your phone would probably offer a better picture in those cases, but it was built for those long exposure shots that you would get by taking photos of space. And in doing so, they were able to, you know, make it not too much bigger than a phone before you attach a lens to it, and included really impressive software for being able to type in, you know, search for specific stellar objects.
Oh.
And actually have the camera have arrows that pointed you up into the sky as to where they were specifically, so that you could, you know, better aim yourself to take photos of them.
Like one of those star map apps.
Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah, it was a star map app, but it was overlaid on top of the camera interface, so that, you know, when you got that ring telling you that you had reached the stellar object that you were searching for, the camera button was then right there for you to take advantage of.
Oh man, that sounds really cool. You also found we just have about a minute left, Russell, but I wanted you to talk about the inkjet printer designed to paint fingernails. What?
this was one of the more bizarre finds that we ran into. This is a company called O2 Nails, and it was this strange little yellow box, and you set your finger inside of this box, and there was an app on one of the phones. You selected an image from the app. You could load up, you know, your own images if you wanted, or you could try and, you know, edit and create something there. And it took, you know, between 5 and 10 minutes, and the image was then painted on one of the fingernails from the demo that we did. And then you applied a clear coat to seal it, and it was done.
What did you get?
I did not get any because I wasn't actually there for it until later.
Okay.
But I probably would have done something silly. One of my coworkers got a puppy painted on his nails. It was very funny.
Russell Holly, thanks as always. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That is Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.